It's that time again, time for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Sutris here, and today we're talking to the publisher of Top Cow Comics, Philip Sablik. Philip joins us to discuss the worlds that are colliding at Top Cow, from the stalwarts like The Darkness and Witchblade, to new series like Broken Trinity, Pandora's Box, and Angelus, all culminating in this year's big event for Top Cow, Artifacts, coming in July. We discuss the directions that Top Cow is heading editorially. We also talk about Pilot Season, conceived this year by Robert Kirkman and Mark Silvestri. And eventually the conversation moves to the inevitable topic of digital comics and what Top Cow's plans are in that market. Now, this was a bit of an experiment for Word Balloon because I decided to try Skype and do my interview that way. I'm a knucklehead when it comes to Skype, and there's this bit of echo on the back of Philip. It's nothing intrusive. It's just literally in the background. If anything, it sounds like there might be a television in a hallway or something like that. Philip is very clear. There's a little white noise on my end. Not really sure why. I'm sure my settings were wrong on Skype. But the conversation is great. I've been very pleased with the level of talk that we've been getting lately in our Word Balloon interviews. I hope you have, too. I think some very interesting ideas and thoughts have come out. Philip is no exception. So enjoy this good conversation with the publisher of Top Cow right here on Word Balloon. You know, this is my first interview via Skype. So, and this was requested by you, so you're being the guinea pig. And if things go bad, then we'll switch over to the phone at some point. But I'm glad to finally have you on Word Balloon. We've always talked at conventions, but this is a good opportunity to have you on and talk about what's going on for 2010 at Top Cow.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show.
You've always helped me out and gotten good people on Word Balloon representing Top Cow in the past. And to prepare, I've tried to catch up with Witchblade in the Darkness. Was interested to hear the after effects of the big crossover event. And it looks like Jackie and Sarah had a baby.
Yeah, the baby came out of Firstborn, which was our event 3 summers ago now.
Because I saw that Sarah and her boyfriend were talking about it. Now, was that his first discovery recently of the baby?
No, it's just, I think what ended up happening was, I think the issues you read were issues 131 through 133, and those issues directly came out of War of the Witchblades, which was a 6-issue Witchblade event. For a while, the Witchblade was split between Sarah Pazzini, who's the longtime bearer from, you know, Witchblade issue 1 and onward.
And Danny.
And Danny, yeah, and as part of that, Sarah did some things that she that revealed kind of a darker side. One of the things that Ron Mars introduced into the storyline was that the Witchblade, being the balance between the darkness and the light, is composed of both of those things. So during War of the Witchblade, Sarah had the dark half, and part of what those issues were about were her and her boyfriend Gleason kind of talking about, you know, the fact that, yes, you know, she was kind of influenced by this dark side of the Witchblade, but at the same time, it was still her, you know, it was her personality. And I think, like any boyfriend would be, you know, if your baby's
freaked out.
Yeah, you're freaked out, you know, because you've got this kid and some other guy's the father, and you know, how do you deal with that? So I think, and it's actually one of my favorite things about the series is that I think, like any other comic fan, I like, you know, big epic events and kind of over the top situations, but I also really, you know, I start off as an X-Men fan, so what I love about comics is it's like the male soap opera, you know, and kind of those character moments are really what kind of pay things off for me. So yeah, you know, we did I think one issue where it was pretty much two people talking about their relationship and what does it mean and where do they go from there, and it just so happens that, you know, the events leading into it were big over the top supernatural you know, slugfest.
The one story that I really liked in particular is the story in 132 and 133, The Bridge. That was really neat. It had a Buffy kind of quality to it, I think, when we learned that what should have been the, you know, who turned out to be the real monster, and you know, who the monster was on the surface, and really what he was skin deep, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the things that Ron does incredibly well. The subtle little twists in the story and kind of playing with your expectations, you know, of what's going to happen, and he kind of takes those police procedural setups and turns them into something which I think is cool, and also lets him kind of share his thoughts and feelings about various topics. And I think, you know, he's a father of three, so I think it's easy for him to, you know, kind of imagine himself in that place and write a story that's compelling from the standpoint of a parent. One of my favorite parts of that story was really the end and how Sarah deals with it, you know, because, you know, I think Ron did a really great job of kind of putting you in her head, realizing like, wow, you know, if I was faced with that and that was the choice I had and I was a parent, I don't know that I would act that differently.
Absolutely. No. And yeah, she turns one predator over to another, and yeah, justice is served in an appropriate way. I love Stefan's art as well. I mean, the guy is gorgeous. I mean, it's just beautiful images. He's a hell of a painter, and the book looks great.
Yeah, thanks. He's one of those really rare finds. I think we've been lucky in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, and that we have 3 or 4 guys that kind of came out of nowhere and are, I think, are catching a lot of people's attention because they don't work like anybody else. You know, Stephen's a unique, not in that he's a digital painter, but he's a digital painter that turns around a monthly book, you know, and I think they're... aren't a lot of guys like that, you know. Even as we start to get more guys in the comic industry that are working digitally, the fact that he consistently, you know, turns around a monthly book on time, the storytelling strong, and he can still deliver those kind of like really breathtaking visuals is pretty impressive. And we, you know, about the same time we actually, you know, we start working with Kenneth Rockfort, who's another guy that I think's very, very unique in the industry. And then Michael Broussard, who does The Darkness. So I think, mm-hmm. you know, and those are the kind of things when you're looking, you know, you're always looking for artists and what I found, you know, being on the other side of the table at conventions is that it's not necessarily hard to find somebody who's a competent storyteller or a solid, you know, artist and can, you know, deliver pages when you need them. But finding those guys that have that X factor, you know, that like wow factor, that when you look at them, you're like, wow, that guy doesn't draw or doesn't paint like anybody else I've ever seen. And there's something really unique and just on a gut level aesthetically pleasing about what he does. So I think we got lucky.
Well, no question, and I'm glad you mentioned Michael as well. One thing that I noticed is 2-issue story arcs, and I don't know if that's just the run you clued me in on, or if that's been the status quo of late.
It's, you know, we actually really try to vary things up. I mean, obviously, on any kind of serialized ongoing, you've got long-term stories, and, you know,
sure.
With Witchblade in particular, I think there are threads and storylines that Ron has developed over years, you know, and some of which haven't resolved yet. But we make a real effort to try to make the series very accessible and ground level for new readers, because we recognize that when you get up, you know, past 100 issues, it can be a little intimidating for a new reader to come in. In particular, after we did the 6-part War of the Witchblade series, we thought it was really important, you know, to give fans, you know, either self-contained issues or, you know, 1-3-part stories, so they didn't feel like, you know, they had to really dive full in.
I noticed that pilot season is you've got 1 issue coming out as we're recording tomorrow.
This year for pilot season, we let Robert Kirkman kind of hijack the whole process with Mark Silvestri. And what's funny is that literally started with Robert dropping an email to me. I've known Robert since he was doing Battle Pope. I think it was probably he started self-publishing about a year before I actually met him through my job at Diamond. And so he just dropped me an email out of the blue. We've kept in touch over the years, and he said, hey, you know, do you guys have pilot season finalized for next year? And I emailed him back and said, you know, no, we're talking to a bunch of people. We don't have it locked in yet, but we would certainly be happy to keep a spot open for you if you have something. You know, and I think it was coinciding pretty well with when the Image partner announcements were coming out, and, you know, he kind of put out his manifesto, so it seemed like a really good idea. And he emailed me back and said, no, I mean, I want to do all of them. I want to take over, which, you know, it's kind of Kirkman's style. You know, he doesn't do anything small. So, you know, we talked about it internally. We thought, you know what, this is a really cool opportunity, and you know, he's definitely a guy that has no shortage of ideas. We decided for 1 year it would be okay to kind of change it up. And I think, you know, the other thing is, you know, pilot season's still relatively new, and we're still figuring out, you know, what works the best and what people respond to. So we figured, you know, why not take a risk and kind of, you know, if you're going to take a risk, Kirkman and Silvestri, it's a pretty calculated.
Good gamble.
Yeah, good gamble. I'd put money on that bet. So, anyway, so Murderer came out. Now Demonic is out with Joe Benitez on art, which was really exciting. And one of the reasons I think Robert wanted to do it with us was he's an Image fan from way back, and they're top Cal artists he wanted to work with. So he came with kind of a whole list of, like, I want to work with this guy and this guy and this guy. And we're like, all right, let's see if we can put that together for you.
Nelson Blake was the artist on Murderer?
Yeah. Yeah, and he was one of the guys that Robert had seen. We had just brought into the studio and wanted to know if he was doing anything. And I think he was actually the first one that we were able to commit to the project, because he was just coming off of doing a Darkness issue, and it was a really good fit. Murderer's of all the books is probably the least immediately visually unique. You know, like, you look at Demonic and there's, you know, kind of a costume to it, and you look at Stealth or Stellar and these other characters, they're a little bit more outlandish. But Murderer is basically a normal guy who just happens to be able to read minds and wants to kill people to quiet the voices in his head. Nelson was a really good fit because he's really, really skilled at conveying emotions through facial expressions. And we knew we wanted somebody that could kind of draw a whole bunch of normal people but still pull you into the story and kind of make it compelling for you.
And I'm looking at Demonic. I'm looking at the cover. I bought the Pilot Season little cheat sheet. And I mean to talk to Robert about these concepts, because some of them do sound interesting. Joe Benitez is obviously a wonderful person to work with. And as you say, a very distinct costume. And Scott Graves is possessed, and he'll do anything the demon asks, as long as he promises not to make him kill his wife and daughter.
Yeah.
Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, the kind of the interesting there are two things. One, when you read the issue, as with most Kirkman books, you'll realize that by the time you get to the end, there's a pretty significant twist to the concept. I don't want to spoil it. But the other thing that, you know, we have been talking about is this idea that here's this guy who's got superpowers, and really part of the idea stemmed from Robert thinking about, like, all right, so you get, you know, these crazy, you know, super strength and the ability to do all these superhuman feats, and what if your mind snapped? What if you couldn't handle it, and so your mind kind of created this construct to justify what you were doing, which in Scott's case is going out and beating up and killing bad guys. And so the question running through the book is Scott actually haunted by an actual demon? Or is it all in his head, you know, and he's had a psychotic break. I think that's the kind of thing Robert kind of excels at, is that characterization. One of the things I keep telling people is that, you know, like, the amazing thing about Kirkman is that he's one of these writers that is almost all execution driven. You know, you hear about a Kirkman book, and, you know, if somebody were to describe The Walking Dead to you or Invincible to you in two sentences, it wouldn't necessarily sound like the most original idea in the world. You know, it would sound like a cool take on a zombie comic, or a cool take on a superhero comic, but you wouldn't immediately go like, ah, I understand why that's, you know, such a great selling title. But when you read them, you realize that he is so skilled at, you know, creating these characters and making you really feel for the people that are in his books. That's what really gets you, you know, is the actual execution of the book, at least I think.
What's the plan for these Pilot Season books? I mean, what has been the plan for the previous winners? Have we seen, how many new series have we seen spawn out of the previous content?
That's a little bit the embarrassing part on the previous contest. We've gotten four winners and one series out. Okay. And part of it is me admitting that, you know, when we got into this, one of the things we didn't really calculate out was, like, how long does it take us to get a series from conception out to the finished product? And it turns out it's a lot longer than one would think. And obviously, you know, like, you can't start developing, you can't have writers and artists working on stuff that may or may not win, you know? So it's kind of like all of these creative teams do a single book, and then they wait to see what the fans, you know, reaction is and who the winner is. And then even if, you know, you get the winner, sometimes it's a matter of like, okay, now we got to work it back into their schedule. Cause these are all freelancers, you know, they're doing other stuff.
And absolutely, man.
Yeah. So it's, Cyblade is the one we got out. Velocity is one that, you will see the first issue in May. And we had a, kind of a back and forth on that one. It was going to come out earlier, and I think we actually solicited it at one point with Joe Casey, who was the original writer on the pilot season book, and Crisscross. And we actually got pretty far into the process, and then we got to a point where Joe wanted to take the story in one direction, and we disagreed. And we kind of went back and forth a little bit, and then, you know, everybody decided, you know what, Joe didn't want to go in the direction we wanted to go, which we completely respect. I mean, you know, it's certainly a creator's prerogative. And you know, we definitely respect him wanting to be true to the work. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, we felt that the story he wanted to tell wasn't necessarily the way we wanted to go with that particular character. So we ended up having to go back to the drawing board. So now we've got the new series coming out. And then Genius and Twilight Guardian are the other two winners, and they're actively being worked on. Genius is Mark Bernard and Adam Freeman, who I believe are working on Wildcats now. Is that right?
Not Wildcats, but I know that because I know Adam Beecham's working on Wildcats, but I know that...
Oh, so it must be Stormwatch.
Probably, it's one of the Wildcats. Also, I loved their older Wildstorm series. That they only had the mini series, but it was great, and I can't remember the name of it right now. The espionage buddy.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It was. Oh, now I'm going to be really embarrassed because I really like.
Yeah, we
book.
Suck. All right, it's cool. We and also, hey Philip, I appreciate the candor on this because I didn't want you to feel embarrassed by it, because if anything, it just points out the reality of, as you say, first of all, working with freelancers, and secondly, I think it kind of pulls the curtain on the reality of what was going on back in the old Showcase days when, hey, let's try this concept out. Well, you had everybody, you know, under staff. This is, you know, a fan selection. And when you do have a winner, you've got to see if the creators themselves, as you say, agree with editorial or further have room in their schedule to pursue.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing, too, is realizing, like, for instance, on using Genius as an example, you know, Mark and Adam are well ahead on scripts, and we've got that, you know, situation well taken care of. The artist, Afua Richardson, had a pretty, you know, kind of tumultuous year last year, just with various things coming up. And she's also one of these creators who does everything. You know, she pencils and colors and does everything digitally and essentially paints the entire book. And it takes her a while to do it, you know. So, like, when you're in a situation like that as a publisher, you could solicit it knowing that it's going to be late, or you can, you know, get the series done and then solicit it, which is what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to be as responsible as we can be. And, you know, if that means that every once in a while, I have to explain to fans why they haven't seen Genius yet, then that's okay. You know, that's fine.
By the way, the series we couldn't think of was The Highwaymen.
Highwaymen, yes. And and I'll make up for it by saying that they were also fantastic when they did Monster Attack Network for AIT.
Indeed. Absolutely. I met Mark briefly in San Diego years ago, and he was a really nice guy, and I enjoy his work at Entertainment Weekly as well. So when Genius is up and running, I look forward to it. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think both of those guys are fantastic. And Troy Hickman is the other winner with Twilight Guardian. And he's actively working on that series. And I think that one will actually move along pretty quickly once we've, you know, kind of ironed out all the kinks. And I think don't hold me to it, but I think we've got a pretty good shot of getting out all of the winning series to date in 2010. or at least, you know, started in 2010. Whether they wrap for the end of the year is, depends on when we start them up. Yeah.
Troy did Troy do Common Grounds back in the day?
Yeah, Troy did do Common Grounds.
I loved Common Grounds. Yeah, that'd be one of my votes for if anything is possible to come back and stuff. I'd love to see more Common Grounds. Very much like Astro City, but definitely had its own identity as well, and it was a good backdrop for some quick, interesting superhero stories.
Yeah, and Troy's a Midwestern guy too. I don't know if you know that, but I want to say an Indiana guy. Cool. But yeah, so he's and it's funny you bring up Common Grounds because it's actually something we are starting to work on with him to bring back. So
great.
Hopefully, a new Common Ground series will be coming down the pipeline.
All right, so we've teased what's coming up. We got three more pilot season entries coming from Kirkman. Do you want to talk about the process? I mean, is it much like previous years? Where are people going to vote, and what's going on with pilot season?
Yeah, so just a kind of quick recap in case some of your listeners aren't familiar with it. The idea is that we put out, in this case, five separate single-issue comics, and the idea is that each comic is a done-in-one story, but at the same time, it serves like a TV pilot. So at the end of the story, hopefully, there's enough of a kind of dangling thread that you want to find out, you know, what comes next in the story. And at the same time, you know, the difficult juggling act is we want to make it satisfying on its own. So hopefully we succeed there. But once all five issues have come out, we'll send out a bunch of, press and kind of make announcements where fans can vote. And it's online voting. Fans can vote once per day for their favorite book. I believe this year we'll probably have the voting go for about 2 weeks.
Okay.
And, we partner with a variety of sites. We've got a pilot season homepage that's on MySpace because the first year we partnered with MySpace to do the promotion. This year we're actually partnering with Diamond as well to have a voting station on previewsworld.com. Okay. And then, I believe last year, we worked with Newsarama as well, and pretty much anybody who is willing to host the voting widget, we're more than happy to work with them and get their support and get as many people involved as possible. So that should be pretty cool. And I believe the other thing we're also working on before the voting starts, we'll also be releasing all five books through our digital partners like Comixology and iVerse and any of the digital partners we have that are interested will make those books available for sale so that if you don't want to go into the store and pick it up, you can check it out online, or if you live overseas and you don't have access to it, we want to involve those fans as well.
Well, now that leads me to one of the questions I wanted to get into, and that is with, the digital age about to really, I think come full force. What is Top Cow's, philosophy in terms of the lag time, if any, between specialty store and digital store?
Well, our current stance is basically we're focusing on two areas. One is archival material, we're putting up early issues of Witchblade and Darkness and making those available. One thing that continues to amaze me is that as, those books have been available either in comic or trade form for almost, I think in Witchblade's case, it's been 15 years, and in Darkness's case, sure, probably about 12 or 13 years. And there are still people, not an insignificant number of people that buy those digitally, just on the iPhone. So we're focusing on the archival, and then for the new material, what we're doing is we're starting with some of the early Ron Mars issues and the early Phil Hester issues. So from a direct market standpoint, those are books that are available in trade at this point. So we feel pretty safe and confident that we're not, digging directly into our direct market partners' pockets on that one. And then the last component is if we sell a book out at the distributor level on the direct market and it's been, anywhere 4 to 6 weeks after release. We feel like that's a pretty safe bet as well. And it really comes from the standpoint of we want to make those books available. For example, with Darkness Pit, we had a really rapid sellout, even though we did, you know, a healthy overprint. So we felt like, why not make that available digitally? You know, and so far it seems to be a strategy that, you know, I haven't had anyone call me up in anger or you know, yelling at me on the internet. So I think we're in a pretty good position there. And the other thing we're, you know, really encouraging people to do, especially like with the free issues, like I think Darkness Pit was our first book. We actually put it up on Comixology first, and we specifically asked them, hey, can we add a page at the end that says next issue, issue 2 is in stores, and I forget what the date was, but we had the date there, and like, you know, check your local comic shop to pick up issue 2. So our hope is that, you know, it does drive physical sales. And one of the things I've said a couple times is, you know, as a publisher, if I believe that all I was going to do was cannibalize the existing customer base for the direct market, that would be probably the dumbest move on the face of the planet. You know, I'd be digging my own grave and nailing the nails into the coffin, because, you know, I don't think it's any big secret, you know, we're going to make less money on a digital download than we do on the physical copy. So the hope is that these digital downloads drive either people into comic shops to buy the next single issue because they want to physically own it, or you know, they read the digital and then go into the store and buy the trade paperback, and you know that we're expanding the audience. That's the hope.
No, I understand that, and yes, and if anything, treating the digital as an entry point and a new customer base, as much as you know, trying to get someone to come into a physical store. I mean, it is harder. I'm curious about the, as you were starting to say, and I don't expect you to give me numbers, but you say on the iPhone, you've been surprised at, you know, how well the books have done. Have they been significant numbers? And again, I'm not looking for a specific number, but I'm just saying, I mean, where, you know, it's exceeded your expectations of how they were going to sell online or digital?
Yeah, and we've only really had stuff up for about a month that I have you know, information on, numbers on it. We basically started with a push in December, and in December, the material we put up because of Apple's approval process was first issues that were available for free download. So the numbers came back great, but it is free. So the real test, I think, will be in the coming, you know, 5 to 6 months as we put up the paid downloads and we see, you know, over a longer period of time what's the kind of sales trajectory for these things. You know, is it steady? Is it my suspicion is that it's going to be somewhat like trade sales, you know, in that because these will be available for a long time and there'll be new material coming out, you know, somebody may not notice Witchblade until, you know, March, but they'll download an issue, like it, and then look on their iPhone and realize, oh, there's, you know, 12 more issues I can download, and they'll go back and they'll download those. So I kind of, my theory, and it's unproven at this point, is that it'll be that kind of slow and steady trade sale. And it'll be, in my mind, it'll be like the book market. It'll be like e-commerce. It'll be like any of these other things. You know, the direct market is definitely the basis of our business, and we want to, you know, support that core. And then all these other things are additional revenue streams that help us publish more books and help us, you know, monetize this stuff. You know, for a while, I think people thought that the book market was going to, you know, be the savior of comics, as if comics need saving. But, you know, like that, you know, Barnes and Noble is going to step in and make everybody rich. And I don't think anybody found that to be true. You know, maybe, you know, unless you're publishing the umpteenth edition of Watchmen, I think, you know, it's a nice additional revenue stream. And that's kind of how I look at digital, you know, and if it takes off and it's something bigger, then all the better.
Are there other, you know, I don't know if it's sales initiatives. I don't even know how to quantify it. But, I mean, you can't help but being in 2010, look to other, you know, looking down the road and seeing exactly, you know, what interests or what developments are going to affect, you know, a company's success. Are there any other avenues that I'm missing beyond the digital environment? I mean, what else can you think of that, you know, is different now than, say, 10 years ago?
Well, honestly, the only other thing I can think of is that, you know, they're definitely – comics are feeding more and more variety of media. You know, it's not just film. You've got comics feeding television, you know, just you know, a couple weeks ago we had the Human Target, you know, debut on television, and that's that's an avenue. You've got video games, you've got animation, you've got you know, anime, you've got you know, motion comics, all these other things that are kind of coming out of the creativity that the comics industry has. And the one thing I have noticed since our company's based out in LA, we meet with a fair amount of you know, studio executives and producers and things like that. And the one thing you realize very quickly is that there are very few other industries that have the level of creativity that comics do. You know, like these the creators we have, the writers and the artists, are so used to creating by themselves. You know, they're not creating in a committee. They're just, you know, sitting in their house, in their studio, wherever, and coming up with these fantastic ideas. And there's not a lot of other industries that do that. And I think it's very, very attractive for people making, you know, this other media. And I'm personally kind of curious to see if, you know, maybe down the road you start seeing more cross-pollination, in the sense that, you know, when a company like Disney is looking to build a franchise, do they look at it from the standpoint of, okay, how can we do a simultaneous launch of, you know, film and television and comics and video games, and how does that all, you know, and merchandise, and how does that all feed into building, you know, something much, much larger? And I really think comics will be a part of that, you know.
What about, you know, and you mentioned in pilot season your partnership with MySpace, the social networking end of the internet. I mean, how involved is Top Cow in that? And, you know, have you been able to ignite that community that maybe started on MySpace and came, you know, through that portal for pilot season and get them to participate further and come to the website or obviously buy the books in stores? I mean, you know, you tell me, have you been able to quantify that in any way?
Honestly, we haven't, you know, and I think that's, you know, we definitely, what I can tell you is I've definitely seen that our trade sales as compared to when I started 3 years ago are better on Witchblade and Darkness than they were when I started. And I think one of my favorite phrases from marketing and advertising is, I know advertising works and I know only 50% of it works, but I can't tell you which 50%. And I think that's true to a certain extent. You know, all these things we do, we know they add up to something. You know, we know they create some sort of momentum, which is why we, you know, I'm active on Twitter, why we're active on Facebook and MySpace and all these things, and have a blog and, you know, keep the website active and do conventions and all these things. But, you know, how much of it comes from that and how much it helps, I don't know.
Another thing, too, is, you know, Witchblade the anime being on IFC, I couldn't help but think back then when it was on, and I was wondering how, you know, if that was getting more people in the door and buying the books.
Yeah, and one thing I will say is we definitely see that apparent at conventions. You know, when I go to a convention, there are, we get a lot of teenagers coming up that say they either saw the anime and thought it was cool and didn't realize there was a comic book, or they did realize and they, you know, they came over to the booth specifically looking for, you know, where can I jump in on the comic book. We saw it with the Darkness video game a few years back, and it was really cool. There was a lot of, like with the Darkness video game in particular, there was a lot of teenage boys coming up that were like, oh man, I love that video game. I didn't realize it was a comic book. Can I get this? And in some cases, they were like pretty young boys, and they were coming up, and I'm always very sensitive, especially if they come up with a parent. And I would say, like, just so you understand, this is not, you know, it's not Spider-Man. It's not a kid's comic. It's you know, a PG-13 to an R-rated comic book for language and violence and, you know, some mature themes. And I think I was kind of surprised how laid back the parents were. And then what I ended up doing after, I think, about 6 months was I would just ask them, like, did they play the video game? And the parent would say yes. And are you okay with that? And what was in the video game? And they say yes. And I said, well, then you're probably fine with the comic, because the video game was a lot harder of a, you know, an R than our comic book is. And that's the funny thing is, like, parents, you know, for all the talk we still hear, you know, and it's unfortunate, you know, that, you know, organizations like the CBLDF have to exist to protect, you know, creators, that there's this, you know, there's still this perception by a large part of, you know, the consumer base that it kind of sees comics should be for kids.
Yes.
And they're not. I mean, you look at, you know, even the books that, you know, Marvel and DC publish by and large, I don't think they're for kids, you know?
No, I agree. And I also think that some are overreactionary, obviously, as well. And you're right. We do need things like the CBLDF, because not only just for creators, but obviously store owners as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and what I found really funny is that even parents that were a little taken back by what was in the comic book had let their kid play the video game or watch the anime. I'm kind of like, those properties were taken a lot further in those other media than we've ever taken them in the comic, you know, and it's kind of a funny story. One of my favorite stories about the anime was the Japanese, when they were getting, Gonzo was getting ready to do the Witchblade anime, Matt Hawkins and Mark Silvestri wrote up a story Bible saying, here's what the Witchblade is. Here's, you know, obviously here's all this reference material, but here are the basic points, and, you know, feel free to change the characters and the setting and blah, blah, blah. But this is what you should, this should remain constant. And they got back, and Matt got back an email after a while. And the question was, one of the questions was, can we include tentacles, referring to tentacle sex? And Matt said, no, definitely not. You may not include tentacles. And shortly afterwards got back another email that said, what about one tentacle?
Hey, man. The anime audience demands its tentacle sex. I'm sorry.
So you,
I am always, I you know, seriously, as someone who isn't into anime, I was shocked the first couple of times I saw tentacle sex as well. I'm like, really? All right. Whatever.
Whatever lets you, but you heard it here first. By Japanese standards, Top Cat was prudish.
Well, and also, I'm glad to hear there are so many parents that understand, because, hey, man, I know I'm a little older than you, but I bet the same went for you as well. There was, you know, Vampirella and Creepy and Eerie, and
yep,
even Marvel Horror. A lot of the black and white stuff went a lot further than what was on the comic book newsstand. And, you know, as far as my parents were concerned, it was just another comic book. And it didn't, you know, I think for the most part we got through it unscarred. And, you know, we're okay.
Yeah, I may have had an unhealthy obsession with Rogue when I was a teenager, but I got through it. And with a little therapy, it was fine.
No, I'm glad to hear that, man. Well, now we mentioned the darkness, and we should talk about the darkness because, you know, Phil Hester, Ron Mars, and you know, they're your two big stars, I think, from a writing standpoint. Not to diminish any of the other writers at Top Cow, but Ron has gotten his due and his, you know, years of work as a writer at all the big publishers, whereas I think Phil is really like the great, you know, kept secret only to a few that know what kind of great writer he is, and I'm glad that he has the opportunity to write over at your guys' place and do such a good job with the darkness.
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, I'm at this point a little surprised and shocked that, like, you know, Marvel and DC don't have him writing like five titles for them.
No kidding, man.
He is probably the, like you said, the best kept, you know, writing secret. He's doing, you know, fantastic stuff for us with the darkness, and we're always talking about a couple other projects. So hopefully, you know, one of those will come to fruition soon. But, you know, he's doing the Anchor at Boom. He's got a couple books at Image with, you know, Fire Breather and Golly and.
His stuff at Dynamite as
yeah.
well that he's doing with Alex Ross. I mean, it's all good stuff.
And Phil just doesn't know how to turn in a bad story. And what's amazing is that a lot of what he's been doing on The Darkness for the last, I'd say, a year and a half since the initial six-issue story arc wrapped up is these brilliant done-in-one stories. And It's in an age of decompression. It's really amazing to see a guy who can tell a really compelling, satisfying story in one issue that doesn't feel cramped. And I think what Phil really has going for him is that because he is an artist, he also knows what you can fit and can't fit into something. You know, he doesn't crush the art with word balloons, and he, you know, it's, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the way Phil actually works is he writes, his scripts are actually very similar to screenplays, where each page has a couple lines of description of, like, this is what the action is on the page, and then he just writes the dialogue. After that's been approved, he sends in layouts for Michael Broussard or whoever the artist he's working with of what each page should kind of look like, or how he would tell it, you know. And so the artist gets these layouts and this kind of like abbreviated script and works from that. And it's really kind of cool.
It was good to see Michael back on issue 82, but I really enjoyed Phil and Andy working together on 80 and 81 in the Bog story. And, you know, it's that's cool, man. I mean, it's rare these days that you do get to see an artist and writer, unless it's the indie world, that really gets to draw and write his own stuff. So it was fun to see Phil stretch both muscles and give a chance for the great Phil and Andy team to do what they do on.
Well, and honestly, part of it is, and I think I, you know, I picked this up a little bit from Rob Levin, who was the former VP of editorial, is like sometimes it's just fun to work with somebody that you like, that kind of fucks with expectations, you know. I don't think anybody would have expected Phil Hester to be writing for us, much less to be writing and drawing two issues of The Darkness. I don't think Phil expected it, you know. But he, in his outline, you know, his original plan, he had this story he wanted to do, and he basically, when he described, he said, "This is the Swamp Thing story that I've always wanted to tell."
Sure. Absolutely.
And it's like, okay, well, why don't you draw it then? You know, and he was like, that would, you know, he's like, are you sure? You know, are Top Cow fans going to accept this? And we're like, yeah. And you know what? If not, they'll deal. You know, like.
I think it's a great addition to the universe. I mean, I think, honestly, not just Swamp Thing, Man Thing, the Heap.
Yep.
I mean, there's a real tradition of swamp creatures in comic books, and Top Cow deserves its own little entry in the universe, and I think you've got one in the box.
Yeah, I think it came out great, and I don't know if you noticed, too, he snuck in another character in there called Scab, which
yes,
I think it's just hilarious. This guy whose only power is that he doesn't feel pain, you know, so he's just constantly getting fucked up and running around and like not caring. So I think that's, I don't know, I really hope there's characters. I think Phil's probably introduced more new characters in his run on The Darkness than I'd have to go back and check, but probably more than any other writer in The Darkness history. You know, he's got a great villain in The Sovereign. He, you know, in his first story arc, he had L, who was this, you know, female manifestation of the darkness power that Jackie created and ended up turning on him. And he just keeps kind of introducing these characters very organically, very just kind of naturally into the story. And then afterwards, you're like, wow, that's a really cool character. Where'd you come up with that?
And it also, because he involves foreign intrigue, I think, in each arc, it gives the stories an interesting backdrop and provides the villains to come from those backdrops as well. So I think it's the same thing goes for Witchblade. I think, you know, at its heart, both books are you know, demonic adventure and have the supernatural angle going for them. But in Witchblade, you've still got that police procedural. And here in The Darkness, and I have to admit, I've mostly been in tune with Phil's run, you get that element of foreign intrigue that I think is unique, and glad to see it in comics.
Yeah, on some level, I would describe the Darkness as like a crime caper book, you know?
Sure.
And the way Phil writes it, it's very noirish, you know, like Jackie, as written by Hester, I think, is very much, in my mind, I describe him as a warrior poet. You know, he's you know, I think he shares something with, you know, guys, you know, like Tony Soprano, where it's like, on the outside, here's this guy that projects himself as this, you know, incredibly tough talking guy, doesn't talk about his feelings. But then what's cool about Hester is you get that internal monologue and you realize, wow, he's this really like poetic soul. Like, and it's kind of messed up, you know, because he's doing all this violent stuff. But at the same time, he's heartbroken about it, or he, you know. And I think the other thing that Phil really crystallized for me was that the darkness at its heart is about a guy who's an orphan and is constantly trying to create a family for himself because he doesn't have one. And that's, you know, I don't think people would expect that from the darkness necessarily.
In Witchblade, as we said, Danny and Sarah were sharing the power, and now Danny is the possessor of the Angelus power?
Yep. That was kind of the big finale. And what's interesting is, a lot of people wouldn't believe this, but Ron had that plan literally from the moment he introduced Danny, which was in issue 100, and she became the Angelus in 130. I think that's, you know, one of the things that's so much fun about playing in this universe, and I think, you know, Ron and Phil would say this, is we've really made an effort to let these two guys kind of develop these stories and do something that's different. The way we operate, because we're, you know, not so much in the business of trying to maintain licenses and you know, keep the status quo, it's never a question of you can't do anything. It's a question of if you're going to change something fundamental, let me hear what your damn good reason is, you know. And that's how we got Firstborn, you know, because on the outset, you know, you try to pitch the story of, oh, well, I want, you know, your main character to have a kid, but she doesn't know how she got pregnant. And then when we have the kid, I don't want to prematurely age them or, like, get rid of them. I want to make her a single mom. And I think, you know, a lot of other places you would have gotten a, yeah, I don't know about that, Ron, you know. But to get back to Danny, like, the entire point in a way of War of the Witchblades, in addition to like kind of wrapping up that era, was to create an origin story for Danny, you know, and to kind of hopefully over these 30 issues and, you know, the various other comics she appeared in, we created a person that people connected with and have some feeling for. And so that when we say, okay, now she's the Angelus and here's this, six-issue series we'd like you to buy, people are like, cool, I want to see where this person goes. You know, I want to see what happens to them.
We see a tie of the Angelus story in the last issue I read of Darkness.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're picking up on there is, you know, we've really made an effort with Ron and Phil, and the nice thing is because we only have those two guys really kind of primarily acting as stewards of the Top Cow universe, create the sense of a shared universe that doesn't feel contrived. You know, like there's this very kind of organic, natural feeling to the fact that these characters share the same universe and they interact and they're all interconnected. But I think if you just, you know, for instance, if you're just a Darkness fan, you read Phil Hester series, you don't have to know what's going on in Witchblade to enjoy that series, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's, you know, it's a hint of something that's to come in the Darkness, but also hinting at 2010's big event, which is Artifacts, which is going to be written by Ron.
What do you want to talk about? How much can you tell us about Artifacts?
Well, I can tell you that it's going to be 13 issues long because there are 13 artifacts in the Top Cow universe. And this is something that we've kind of laid the groundwork for years. Definitely intensively for 5 years, but you know, there are hints of it going back, you know, to Paul Jenkins' run on Witchblade and Universe and Tom Judge. There's hints of it in Magdalena series. And the idea is that there are these 13 mystical artifacts that kind of guide and influence the fate of the Top Cow universe. And in this series, first of all, we're going to reveal what all 13 are because we haven't done that as of yet. We've intentionally kept some of them hidden. And we've hinted at the fact that if you take all 13 and you bring them to the same place all at one time, potentially something very, very bad is going to happen. So we figured it was time to lay our cards on the table, put them all together, and make something really bad happen. It's definitely the most ambitious thing I've ever attempted, you know, I think it should be really cool if we pull it off. You know, I think it's something we're very, very excited about internally, because it's such a huge story, and it's something that we want not only to serve as an introduction for new fans, and you know, something you'll probably hear me say 300 times in the next 6 months is, you know, if you're never read a Top Cow book and you only read one Top Cow book this year, I want it to be Artifacts, because I think this is going to be us putting our best foot forward. It's going to be grand and epic in scale, but hopefully have that same kind of emotional core that, you know, Ron brings when he writes Sarah and Jackie and all those characters. And then for the, you know, diehard fans, it's going to be kind of a culmination and a payoff for all this time and money they've invested in our stories, you know, and hopefully it's a payoff that they enjoy.
So will Artifacts, will the, you know, Witchblade and Darkness, will they have Artifacts tie-in issues? Will there be, you know, stories running parallel to what's going on in Artifacts? How will that work?
It's going to work in both ways, actually. There are going to be some issues that are tie-in issues, and there are also going to be, you know, parallel stories that are kind of running alongside. You know, we're still kind of fine-tuning the details with Ron and Hester as well, because obviously even though Ron's writing Artifacts, we want to make sure that, you know, we're respectful of the stories that Hester has planned and he wants to tell, and that we don't completely hijack, you know, what he's doing in the Darkness. But I think it'll all work together. The Angelus is building towards that series that Ron's writing. We've got another series launching next month called Broken Trinity Pandora's Box, which picks up where Broken Trinity left off. We had introduced two new artifact bearers in that series called their names are Finn and Glory, and they kind of they wield these two artifacts. They're kind of like fire and ice artifacts. And that's going to be a really cool book. It's a series that Rob Levin, who I mentioned before, was a former editor of ours, and Brian Edward Hill, who's a new writer, they're co-writing that series, and Alessandro Vitti, who just came off of a nice several-issue run on Secret Warriors for Marvel, he's drawing that. But that series is going to be very much if – you know, Witchblade is our police procedural supernatural, and Darkness is our crime caper supernatural. This Broken Trinity Pandora's Box is our globe-hopping adventure series. It's our Alias, Indiana Jones, Tomb Raider, James Bond, all rolled into one. Basically the idea behind that series and why it's a direct artifact lead-in series is because both of these characters have been charged with gathering the 13, and they're competing. It's basically a treasure hunt race. You know, like you got to get it before this other person gets it. And they're still figuring out why they're doing what they're doing and what it means. And, you know, all they know is somebody's told them, you got to go do this. And the one character, Glory, has been kind of groomed from a very young age to take on this mantle. And the other guy, Finn, is just kind of a normal guy who got handed this, and he's still trying to make sense of stuff that he doesn't even believe in, you know. So it's a pretty cool setup, and I'm really excited to see what people think about that, because it's, I think, different than what, you know, they're getting in Witchblade and Darkness. You know, the plan with Artifacts is hopefully to create something that is just relentless and big and epic, and you know, every issue you're left wondering, you know, how are they going to top the last issue?
Is it, is the Broken Trinity Pandora's Box, is that a mini series, or is that the beginning of an ongoing?
Yeah, that's a mini series. It's a 6-issue series. And generally what, you know, what we say is, you know, most of our series, unless we announce them outright, you know, at the beginning and really, heavily, you know, drive home the fact this is an ongoing. Most of our series are limited series to start with, or, you know, we'll do them in kind of season chunks. And then, you know, if the fan response is there, obviously I would love nothing more than to have more ongoings. You know, if the fan response and the retailer support is there for something like Broken Dream, Pandora's Box, I know Rob and Brian have plenty more stories they'd love to tell. So it's just on some level, being a mid-sized publisher, you know, we're kind of reacting to what the market tells us. Both Angelus and Broken Tree and Pandora's Box are essentially lead-in series for Artifacts, which kicks off in July.
Okay, so for the first half of the year, we read these two series, and then, if we like where we're going, then we continue with Artifacts in the second half.
That's the hope. That's the plan. And hopefully we do everything we're supposed to, and all these books ship on time, and it'll be like clockwork.
What else should we be aware of in this 2000?
I think the other thing that people should probably keep an eye out for is if they enjoyed Murder, we're doing a relaunch of a classic Top Cow character, Magdalena, in April. And that's with Ron Mars writing, and then Nelson Blake, Sal Regla, and Dave McKay, who are the Murder art team. They're doing the art chores on that. So that's going to be I think at this point, at least an 8-issue series. There's an initial 6-issue arc, and then issues 7 and 8 are going to be kind of a 2-part story that should be pretty special. But the idea there is, Magdalena is a character that's kind of that Ron's been wanting to write for a long time, and she's popped up into the Top Cow universe quite a bit lately, and so we want to make it a series that people can come into very cleanly, kind of a year one approach to Magdalena, because it's a character that I think a lot of people have interest in but has kind of a convoluted past. So we're trying to clear it up, and so we'll be launching that in April, we've got beautiful, like, breathtaking covers by Ryan Sook. And I know you shouldn't buy a book just for the cover, but if you were to buy a book just for the cover, Ryan Sook might be the reason to do it, because
I understand.
If I could, sell a child off to get him to actually draw an ongoing Magdalena book, I think I could die a happy man. Before I forget, I'd be really remiss if I didn't mention that for Broken Trinity's Pandora's Box, we got really lucky, and we got Tommy Lee Edwards to do the covers for that. And
wow.
He is just, Tommy Lee Edwards, awesome to begin with, but the covers he's been turning in have just been blowing our minds, absolutely. So,
very cool.
That's probably it. I mean, I'm probably, what do you think? Have I talked your ear off enough?
No, this is good, man. Your established icons are in good hands, and I'm intrigued by what I'm hearing about Pandora's Box, because I think some of the characteristics that I was putting on the darkness, you're telling me I'll find even more of it in Pandora's Box, so that gets me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, speaking of that international flavor, I think in the first issue, Rob and Brian have no less than, I think, 5 different worldwide settings. So there's when I say globe hopping, I really mean globe hopping. The thing I like to tell people is whatever your preconception is of Top Cow as a company or the types of books we do, I think what we really offer people is those other genres that they love in movies and television and novels, whether it's suspense or horror or crime or, police procedural, detective, like all those things, tied in with just a little bit of that superhero element that makes it kind of a little bit of a comfort food, So it's not a complete shock to the system.
No. And also, if anything, it reminds me of when the Warren publications would kind of dabble in, if not superhero, superpowered beings.
Yeah.
And it had that very, distinct look and feel that was different than what Marvel and DC were giving you on a slightly more adult level. And sophisticated art and great writers, and I think it's great, and I'm glad to hear what your feelings are too of as the comic world is changing. These different markets are starting to open up, and the way things look as we start our new decade. So
yeah, it's going to be
appreciate your perspective.
It's going to be a really interesting next decade. I think it's going to be a really interesting, next 2 or 3 years. Definitely with all the shakeups that happened in the last year, it should be really, really fascinating to be a part of, and even just fascinating to watch.
What conventions can we find you guys at this year?
Too many.
I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've looked at the convention schedule. It's going to be insane. But this year, I actually just hired a few months back a new marketing assistant to help me out with conventions. So off the top of my head, you know, convention promoters, please forgive me if I forgot your show that we're doing. But we're doing WonderCon, C2E2, Calgary. And then, you know, of course, we'll be at New York Comic Con, San Diego. We'll be at Baltimore again this year for sure.
Cool.
I'm really excited about C2E2. Very, very excited to be in downtown Chicago, and you know, me and CB Cebulski and a couple other people are already like have our restaurant list of places we want to go to, and I'm clapping. I don't have to, you know, eat at Gibson's for the third night in a row.
Well, and that reminds me, you know, aren't you part of that group that worked with Ron Richards on that comics foodie podcast?
Yes, and we've made a New Year's resolution to record more episodes because we've definitely you know, eaten a bunch of different places, and we I don't know, it's kind of fun. It's a weird cross section, but somehow it makes sense.
Well, you know, when I see CB's tweets of the photographs of food that he always puts up there, so I think it fits. And also, as you say, I mean, downtown Chicago, you're not going to go wrong. I already told Ethan Van Sciver I'm taking him. It's not the greatest place for a foodie, but Miller's Pub is a just old sports bar that really dates back to the 40s and has, you know, the pictures on the wall and the real history inside of the restaurant with memorabilia and stuff. That it really was a big Chicago sports hangout, really for decades in the 20th century, and it's. I told Ethan about it, and he's all excited, so he wants to go.
Oh, that sounds great! It's Miller's what now?
Miller's Pub.
Miller's
You're
Pub.
Welcome to join us, man.
I will take you up on that.
I can't promise you gourmet food. It's definitely a diner, but its history makes it worth the trip in my book. So, and I still love the place. It's got good, you know, decent diner food.
Cool. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm from. You know, I spent more than a decade in Baltimore, so I appreciate a good pub with you know, some decent beers on tap.
There you go. Attaboy. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate you being the first lab rat doing a Word Balloon Skype interview. I think everything worked out okay.
Cool. Well, I hope so, and let me know if it all just sounds like gobbledygook.
That's Philip Sablik, publisher of Top Cow. Lots of good books coming out from Top Cow. In fact, we'll be talking to one of the Top Cow writers, Phil Hester, in a couple episodes, and also count on a talk with Ron Mars, if not before C2E2, sometime in late spring, early summer, here on Word Balloon. That'll do it for this edition. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon can be found right at our home, wordballoon.com. Big archive there of interviews to go through. Make sure you check them out. We've also got some interesting video as well. Make sure you come to wordballoon.com. Check it all out. Questions or comments about the show, always feel free to either ask me via Twitter, where I'm under John Word Balloon, my Facebook page. You can email me, john@wordballoon.com. There's the Word Balloon message board. The link is right there at wordballoon.com. Follow it. Subscribe to the message board. Join the conversation on not only our interviews, but also other pop culture topics. Make sure you subscribe to the Word Balloon feed via iTunes. Don't miss an episode. And if you have any interest in leaving ratings or a review of the show, that's always appreciated as well. Until next time. Thanks again. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.